18. It's a shorty. That's good. And I think it is intended not as a definition, which is roughly how both Alice and McGuire read it, but simply as a further elaboration of the thesis by means of a comparison. So on my reading, let me say what's going to happen, and then we'll look at that. So what's going to happen. Does. On my reading, paragraph 18 is a discussion of the difference between the transcendental unity of apperception, which is again the unified grasp, all that stuff, and the subjective or empirical unity of consciousness. So paragraph 18 is going to draw a contrast between the way he's reading our account of our being in a representational state and contrasting it with the way in which Locke and Berkeley, for example, treat our being in a representational state. So on Kant's account, objective unity, that is the kind of unity in which there is a representation of an object, is the result of a priori synthesis. Subjective unity is the result of contingent habits of association. So, for example, Locke says, and this is Locke trying to figure out how an idea represents an object. How these ideas that I have, red, round, sweet, and so on, come to represent an apple. And he says, the mind takes notice that a certain number of simple ideas go constantly together. That is, regularity, that I'm pretty used to seeing roundness and redness and sweetness going together. Indeed, they constantly go together in my past, which, now I'm quoting Locke again, being presumed to belong to one thing, wait a minute, being presumed to belong to one thing, the roundness and the redness and the, I presume, because they always come in these little groups, I presume that they belong to one thing, are called so united in one subject by one name, an apple. So what makes an apple is a regularity of the presentation of simple ideas constantly associated together. And the same thought you can find in Berkeley, where he says, for example, a certain color, taste, smell, figure, and consistence, having been observed to go together, are accounted one distinct thing, signified by the name apple. philosophers love that apple. And of course, you may want to know, why always the apple? Why always going back to the Bible?
Yeah.
Right? Why always is it Eve?
It was a green apple, wasn't it?
It wasn't an apple, was it? It was a pomegranate. Right? Right, let's not go there. Let's not get into biblical exegesis. What did then ancients know about apples? Okay. So, for 4 the empiricists, for the idealists, roughly it's going to be some version of regularity and association under certain conditions. That is, normally when I am in, and usually given as a series of conditionals, which are usually taken as defeasible conditions, namely, if I am in, I'm awake, I'm in a well-lighted room, and I'm having these impressions of red and round, and in the past, I've called that an apple, then, ceteris paribus, I'm seeing an apple. Now for Kant, that's a simply contingent fact, right? And it's the contingent going together with a other series of contingencies under a caritas paribus clause that's going to constitute, miraculously, knowledge. For Kant, what the empiricists accomplish by regularity, habit, association, he replaces that with form. And I think paragraph 18 simply says this and shows that if we take on board what's going on here, then we are bound to think, right, that really what the empiricists are talking about is a contingent state of my empirical consciousness, not an awareness of an object. So, let's see if paragraph 18 says just that. Of course, you know it really. I cooked the books here. I read it before. The transcendental unity of action. Some people ask, what does it take to want to be a professional philosopher? One thing it takes is to find reading a passage like this 30 or 40 or 50 times, continually thrilling. I find this thrilling. Now, you may say, poor sick bastard. But at any rate, I do find this really exciting. Because, why? Because it takes the most obvious thing in the world that I'm in a state of awareness of an object and unearths it in all its richness and complexity. So philosophy has the habit of making the simple, the simplest thing, infinitely complex and rich. I find that exciting, really. The transcendental unit of apperception, probably more of a confession than we wanted there. The transcendental unit of apperception is that unity through which all the manifold given in intuition is united in a concept of the object. Just a restatement now of the transcendental term. so you know about perception, is the grasping of a thing in the concept of an object. Concept of an object, how, where does that come from? We'll get to. It's going to come from the categories. So our categories are going to be our concept of an object in general. Concept of an object in general, that's what the categories are. And therefore, synthesizing something through them with a particular concept is going to allow for relation to an object. It is therefore entitled objective and must be distinguished from the subjective unity of consciousness, which is a determination of inner sense. Inner sense is I'm going to give a loose definition, we'll come to a tighter definition later. Inner sense is my awareness of my own inner states. So subjective unity of consciousness, which is a determination of sense, through which the manifold of intuition for such objective combination is empirically given. That is, corresponding, of course, to any objective awareness. I'm aware of an object as having these features. They must correspond a state of my consciousness. So if, as it were, I turn my attention not away from the object and back towards the state of my consciousness, I will find there that relationship of things, of representations. Whether I can become empirically conscious of the manifold as simultaneous or successive depends on circumstances or empirical conditions. That is, how I'm aware of a particular manifold as an object or as an event, that's not up to me. That's up to contingent circumstances. What's not up to contingent circumstances, therefore, the empirical unity of consciousness through association of representations itself concerns an appearance and is wholly contingent. So my awareness of my empirical consciousness as either changing or as an awareness of a thing is itself contingent. Because any state of inner sense is either going to be an awareness of something there or something changing, one of the two. Some possibility. But the pure form of intuition in time, let me skip all that, it's just for confusion. Skip down one sentence. Only the original unity is objectively valid. Only the original unity of perception. Valid. The empirical unity of apperception. The empirical unity of apperception is simply my awareness of my own inner states. Upon which we are not here dwelling, and which besides is merely derived from the former under given conditions in concreto, has only subjective validity. What's that about? Well, one thing that Kant is interested in here is that people conflate inner sense and apperception. He's wanting to distinguish that. That's really what's going on here, right? And that repeats an argument he takes up later where he makes the conflation clear at B153, 1B155. I won't read the passages. He's just interested at the moment in the conflation. I'll come back to those passages in a moment. The reason look at that sentence I just read again. Because it says something really unobvious, and yet it's, I think, one of the keys to the argument. Only the original unity is objectively valid. Well, that's okay, we're used to that. But here's the funny thought. He says the empirical unity of our perception, that is, the empirical unity of my inner awareness, is merely derived from the former under given conditions in concreta. My inner awareness, he's claiming, is derived from my outer awareness. So the argument he is making here is that my capacity to be aware of my own inner states is secondary and derivative from my original awareness of particular objects in the world. So the claim is, and this, by the way, for me is the kicker for the regressive argument. Because if this is right, what's he saying? The first thing he's saying is, do not. He has complained, he is suggesting that empiricism generates a genetic fallacy. And the genetic fallacy comes about this way. The empiricist, robust Lockean common sense, says, look, how is it possible for me to be aware of an object? And Locke tells an absolutely plausible story. Namely, light waves hit the goddamn object, hit my eyes, and then my mind puts them together and constructs an object. That's the genetic story, right? And therefore, he begins by atomistically with the elements and constructs a whole. Kant's procedure is exactly the opposite. He says the minimum form from which we must begin is awareness of an object. So he's saying the genetic order, the order in which things come to be, is not their true order. Their true order, that is what comes first, is the whole. And what he means by that is It's only on the basis of our awareness of objects that we learn how to think about our inner states. What do I mean by that? The Seleozine story tells a nice version of that. I say the cup is green. And you all jump at me and say, look again, the cup is not green. And I look again and I say, and here's the thing, it appears green to me. So now it's appearing green to me is my awareness of my inner state. I'm talking about not how it is, but how I am experiencing it. And I learn to do that how? By learning that not everything that I claim is the case is the case. And therefore I have to learn to go from is to appears. That is, Kant wants to say that learning how things are is first, and how they appear to inner sense is a secondary and derivative thing. And indeed, we're often told, you know, the story about cubism, for example, is, of course, nothing looks like a cubist object. But, you know, the story is if you learn to squint at objects, well, if you learn how to think about your perceptions in a certain way, you can see, right. Well, this is that kind of story. Kant's claim here is you've got to begin with the whole and the relationship to the object. And on the basis of that, in particular conditions, you can learn to examine, that is, to rehearse your own inner states, and that their contingent unity, is parasitic in general on objective unity. Why would one think that? Well, we need to view a kind of standard Wittgensteinian story. Namely, you can have one bit of language, red, you don't know what red is, until you know red is different from green and blue and yellow. And you can't know about things being red or green or blue without there being objects that are red and green, right? So eventually, in order to have any bit of language, to have a concept, you must have a lot of concepts, and not just a lot, but you need them to, in Wittgenstein's talk, participate in particular language games. Say the language game of reporting, or stating, or judging. That's the Kantian language game in particular. Things are such and such, or the causal language. This happens about that. This calls back. So the thought here in paragraph 18 is that object of awareness is logically, well, let's put it transcendentally, prior to subjective consciousness. Now, it's that thought for me which bears on the regressive argument. Because if holism is true, then the idea of beginning from mere experience is unintelligible, right? It buys too much of the genetic fallacy. So my claim is that if the anti-skeptical reading of Kant is true, then the sentence I just read you is unintelligible as a part of the deduction. But on my account, perfectly consistent. So the starting point for Kant, to repeat, is not private sense data, but judgments about the objective realm. The opposite of that is not subjective experience, but incohate experience. That is, I'm denying that we go from subjective to objective. That seems to me what's impossible. Rather, we go from incohate, not having a world at all, to having a world, and in light of having a world, learning about our own subjective path through it. Yeah?
This argument seems similar to the refutation of idealism.
A refutation of idealism, well, this is a formal version of that. The refutation of idealism is going to state that in another way. You're absolutely right, because it's going to say that inner time consciousness is dependent on outer spatial awareness. Yep. But in that case, he's going to do it as a refutation of skepticism. Here it's not a refutation, it's a further elaboration of the argument for the transcendental unit of our perception. But you're absolutely right. It's an absolutely parallel case. And the refutation of idealism actually just hammers that in a detailed way with respect to time consciousness.
So you're just translating pure and empirical apperception into outer and inner sense?
Objective and empirical.
He's using...
The original unit is objectively valid, the empirical unit of apperception. Yeah, so objective is here object awareness. So it's...
I just don't see where you're getting the objects from.
From the role of intuition in the previous sentence.
So you're saying the pure form of intuition in time, that's
on it? We're there, he's just giving the story I've just been giving, but adding on time. I'm just doing transcendental apperception versus empirical unity of apperception.
Right.
And that's contingent versus necessary, objective versus subjective. And he's claiming that the subjective is parasitic on the object.
Right, because the objective is tied directly to time, and subjective is just contingency.
Right.
Yeah.
Of course, he is not really got the outer going yet. He's just simply saying, whatever we are as awareness of a particular, right? He doesn't have a robust notion of externality, which is what he does do in the refutation of idealism. But I am claiming that once you know, the natural way of reading that is to already put the Solaresian spin on it. Otherwise, the sentence just makes no sense. I don't understand how the parasitism is going to work if it's not going from I see red to it appears red to me. Because that does shift exactly from something that has the form of a necessary, and we'll talk about necessity in a moment, to a merely empirical unity of consciousness. Which itself is a judgment, I will go through all that. paragraph 19. Well, for us, because I am one of the few who love the metaphysical deduction, paragraph 19 should now come as no surprise, since all this stuff, that spontaneity is a source of objectivity, synthesis is a source of objectivity, it's all about unification. Paragraph 19 is really going to recross the whole terrain of the metaphysical deduction. So he says, at the very end of B141, I find, right before B142, I find that a judgment is nothing but the manner in which given modes of knowledge, which I think he just means representations, are brought to the objective unity of our perception. Judgment is nothing but the way in which modes of knowledge are unified to become awareness of an object. This is what is intended, and this is what hammers it in, this makes it follow right from my argument, this is what is intended by the copula is. What does he mean by that?
Pomegranate is red?
That will do, right? So what does the pomegranate is red mean? Now, go ahead.
It means that I have object awareness of the pomegranate through the unification in which I become aware of it.
And where does the notion of judgment come from here? Where's the judgment bit of this? You're doing great.
From the grasping of it together?
Yep. And how is the grasping of it together a judgment? S is P. That's where the is. The is, right? So saying something is the case, the pomegranate is red, is nothing more than the form of holding the representations together in a unity, but insofar as I so grasp them and unify them, it says that I am aware of the pomegranate as having the property red. So all the business about synthesis is now translated into judgment talk. Judgment is how we judging is synthesizing. So we can, as it were, dump that technical word, and instead of saying we synthesize our representations, we can say we put our representations together into a judgment. And putting them together into a judgment requires judgmental form. And that judgmental form confers upon those representations the power to be cognitions of an object. Not just cognition, my cognition of an object, because I'm doing the judging.
Yeah. Does this mark a radical break from the A deduction, the threefold synthesis, where the sort of recognition of the concept is?
Nope.
No.
Nope. Right? As I'll come back, we'll see the A deduction occurs in paragraph 24. In paragraph 26, they go over some of that stuff. So my reading is, now, the whole business, A deduction, B deduction, as I said, it's just a matter of presentation. I don't see any difference in argument. Of course, you can all write long PhD pieces showing why Bernstein's been wrong all along. That would be fun, at least for me. Hell for you. I wrote a PhD on Kant. I know it's hell. Next sentence is terribly important. It indicates, next two sentences, it is employed to distinguish the objective unity of given representations from the subject. Just what Ed and I were arguing about, right? It's giving the things the logical form that literally is what distinguishes objective from subject. So how do I gain objectivity? I make judgments. How do I get out of my subjectivity? I make judgments. Or as Wittgenstein would say, I talk. I learn to talk. I learn to say the pomegranate is red. It indicates and we're just, I don't know about you, but sometimes you can wonder what it refers to in Kant. I'm never sure he's sure, but the rest of the sentence gives us enough to not get too lost there. It indicates their relation, a couple of his, their relation to the original apperception and its necessary unity. It holds good, even if the judgment is itself empirical, and therefore contingent, as for example, bodies are heavy. And here then he clarifies that, and I'll clarify it for you. I do not here assert that these representations necessarily belong to one another in the empirical intuition, but that they belong to one another in virtue of the necessary unity of apperception in the synthesis of intuition. Blah, 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 blah. Let's see if I can make sense out of that. That redness necessarily belongs to apple, and if he was committed to saying that, he'd be nuts, right? Because there are green apples and pink ladies, which aren't never quite pink, are they? Well, it's a great name. I love the name Pink Ladies. I always think of something kind of slightly fake. So where's the necessity? The necessity is in the form through which I bring apple and red together. That is, the necessity comes from what is necessary is the structure, right? That is, necessarily I bring my representations necessarily to unity, and that necessity confers objectivity on the actual representation. Why necessary? Well, we've been doing that for the last 2 hours, because if it wasn't the case, then my awareness of a complex intuition would not be a cognition at all. So it's in virtue, necessary, it's in virtue of their unification in the judgmental form that they are awareness of an object. So it's a transcendental necessity that underlies that an empirical unity can be objective, a contingent unity can nonetheless be objective. That's what he means by that sentence. I do not here assert that these representations necessarily belong to one another, or happiness and redness do not necessarily belong together. I'm not saying that, he says, but that they belong to one another in virtue, they belong to one another at all, in virtue of the necessary unity of apperception, because that is what confers on my representations relationship to an object and makes them a cognition. So the copula is to distinguish the objective unity of given representations from the subjective. Thus, the very bottom of the page, to say that the body is heavy is not merely to state, and this is again just to repeat the argument I made about paragraph 18. Thus, to say the body is heavy is not merely to state that two representations have always been conjoined. Whenever I'm aware of a body, I'm aware of heaviness, especially my body, right? It's not merely to state the two representations have always been conjoined in my perception. However often the perception is repeated, repetition of their constant conjunction doesn't make it true. What we are asserting is that they are combined in the object. No matter what the state of the subject may be. So now we have an extra kicker here. When I suggest the apple is red and I'm so judging it, I am saying that redness belongs to the apple, irrespective of my contingent state of awareness or feeling or the like. That is, and here's another way of putting it, I am not making the judgment as a report on my inner state, and then projecting it outward, rather the outward again comes first. The unified apperception of representations, Kant is stating, cannot be grounded in contingent psychological features of the cognizing subject. They must be based on essential features of the cognizing mind, And he's now going to add that up. And he's going to pull all this together in paragraph 20. I can see I'm not going to finish, but let me just read paragraph 20 because Kant means it as a summary to here. So we'll end with this and we'll start with it next week. Where are we? He says. The manifold, given in a sensible intuition, is necessarily subject to the original synthetic unity of our perception, because in no other way is unity of intuition possible. That's the spontaneity thesis. No unity without unification. Unification must not only be just unification, but must be unified. Unification, finding the object hanging together. But the act of understanding by which the manifold of given representations, be they intuitions or concepts, is brought under one apperception, is the logical function of judgment. That is, we get the oneness through the logical forms of judgment. That is, they give us the kind of unity, that representations need in order to represent. Right? SSP is the kind of hanging together of a thing that allows it to be an awareness of an object property. That's the repetition of the metaphysical deduction. All the manifold, therefore, so far as it is given in a single empirical intuition, is determined in respect of one of the logical functions of judgment, and is thereby brought into one consciousness. That is, anything that I can be aware of has to be subject to some unification. The logical functions of judgment, which we looked at in the metaphysical deduction, give us the possibilities, if then, SSP, so on and so forth. And therefore, anything that we might be aware of in empirical intuition is brought under some logical function of judgment, because that's a condition of cognitive unity. Now, this could be the conclusion of the whole deduction. Now, the categories are just these functions of just judgment. What are categories? They are themselves nothing but these logical functions of judgment, insofar as they are employed in determination of the manifold of a given intuition. That is, what are the categories? The categories are not SSP, subject is predicate, but substance and attribute. So insofar as I judge through the categories, judge through the logical functions of judgment, their determination of an intuition is nothing but the use of categories. Therefore, anything for which I can have an awareness of is a priori subject to the categories, QED. You're stuck. First of all, why is there another five paragraphs? Well, we'll come back to that next week. So suffer with this over the next week. We'll start exactly here and try to figure out where we are. And we will go on. Certainly, since I know you, many of you are schematism mad, do look at, read the schematism, and hopefully we will finish off, and it will fit together for reasons we'll see. We'll finish off the deduction and do a bit of schematizing next week, which seems a nice thing to do. And you have.